When you see starving people turn up in what is effectively a fenced-off cattle pen, dehumanising Palestinians to the point where they're being regarded as animals, they're being herded like animals into a human abattoir. For the last 6 weeks, about 1,000 of them have literally been slaughtered. And this is all being done in the name of humanitarianism. So to be absolutely clear, an army that has put a fence around a people, blockaded it for 17 years, has starved people to death, builds these agricultural pens, forces these starving people to come and get food aid from them. When they get there, they're targeted and shot, and then they're carried off to hospitals where there are no pharmaceuticals. I've always called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the GHF, the genocide humanitarian fig leaf, which is precisely what I think it is, because if you're going to get rid of UNRWA, you've got to reinvent some new thing. And what they did is they went to a bunch literally of cowboys, of former Marines and American service people, ex-servicemen, and said, we want you to do humanitarian work.
Contractors shooting in the direction of Palestinians who had just collected their food and were departing.
People who've been starved literally to death are crawling to get food. They're being shot at directly by marksmen, Israeli marksmen. Nearly 700 people have been killed waiting for food in the last 6 weeks. Over 200 have been killed on the routes going to collect food. That's about 1,000 people, not that many fewer than the number of people who were killed in the October 7th attacks. And yet, so little outrage. They said the big justification for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the GHF, was to stop Hamas diverting aid. And yet what we have seen for the last 6 weeks or more since it came into existence is militants and others, criminal gangs and others, nourished and nurtured by the Israeli army, encouraged by them to go and shoot people.
Its leader, Yasser Abu Shabab, is an alleged former drug trafficker. Now he and up to 300 men are openly working with the new, much-criticised aid distribution scheme backed by Israel and the US. But in the past, he's been accused of looting vast quantities of desperately needed aid.
That's what the GHF was all about. And it's, for my money, it is part of the much bigger strategy, which is about ethnic cleansing and genocide. They're starving people out of the north of Gaza to the south of Gaza. When they get there, they're being shot at. And the clear message is, get out or stay here and starve or be shot dead.
We've seen an internal UN document from late last year that describes Abu Shabab as a criminal, a gang leader and a primary figure in the systematic looting of humanitarian aid. And it says his base is in an area controlled by the Israeli military.
An Israeli opposition leader is making similar claims. Israel has provided assault rifles and light weapons to crime families in Gaza on Netanyahu's orders. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded by confirming he's supporting what he calls clans.
On the advice of security officials, we activated clans in Gaza that oppose Hamas. What's wrong with this? This is only good and saves the lives of IDF soldiers.
The label humanitarian is used by Israel to justify pretty much anything. So as long as you say it's humanitarian, you can do it. So a humanitarian city, i.e. a concentration camp, becomes acceptable because you're using the word humanitarian, implying that there's some kind of humanitarian effort. It's a bit like using the most moral, like Israel was the most moral army in the world. Is this the most moral concentration camp in the world? The Israeli army is the Houdini of modern warfare because they just escape, they get out of anything. And I think the philosophy is the bigger the lie, the more people will believe it.
We never target civilians.
We do not target civilians.
We would never target civilians.
There is not a chance in the world that Israel is purposely targeting civilians.
We're going out of our way to prevent civilian casualties.
The more you say we're not targeting civilians, the more civilians you can target. And that's precisely what's going on. And to make no mistake, Israeli politicians hardly keep their cards close to their chest. Netanyahu, almost from the start, said, we will do an Amalek-type genocide.
Zachor et asher asa lecha ma'amalek nitztavenu. Anu zochrim v'anu nilchamim.
Amalek, this was the biblical injunction in the first book of Samuel. The Lord says to the prophet, go and kill Amalek, kill all of the tribe, kill their women, their children, their babies, their livestock, exterminate them. And not only did Netanyahu invoke this publicly, there were then soldiers in Gaza singing about Amalek.
Before
posting Amalek injunctions.
Baruch Hashem, achravnu lahem shetach atzum, haragnu bahem asrot alafim shel Amalekim.
As they pressed buttons and blew up apartment blocks behind them. We have the intentionality to commit genocide, and we have the soldiers on the ground committing genocide. They've said it, and they get away with it, and that's the problem. Western governments have let them get away with it. That's what's led to today. I mean, it is deeply ironic that the occupying power, Israel, whose job it is to protect a population, is starving it to death. What's also interesting, of course, is that that's one of the charges against Netanyahu at the International Criminal Court. It's clear evidence that these charges against him are going to stick, because we're seeing live streamed on our television Israel starving people to death and shooting them. So how ironic that an army, an organization, a country that has been imposing the blockade against Gaza has been starving them to death and yet is in charge of the aid distributions. I mean, how sick is that? When I first started in UNRWA in 2007, Gaza was the place that most needed a communications director. That's the place I spent most of my time, often 4 or 5 days a week. Gaza is a place I know well. I've spent a lot of time there. My own office has been reduced to rubble. And so, of course, it's been heartbreaking, not just because of, you know, the UNRWA operation being illegally cut short, but also because the people I know, the colleagues I had and the friends I have in Gaza, many of them have been killed, many of them have been driven into exile, and many of them are living homeless and in the most appalling concentration camps, as they're now being called, for 2 years or more. UNRWA, for many people, including the Palestinians, stands for their individual and collective rights. It protects the right to education, it protects the right to health, etc., etc. But at a much greater level, it also is an expression of an institution that protects the refugee rights, including the right of return. And for Israelis, who clearly feel that if the right of return were implemented, the Jewish character of the state would be destroyed, they see UNRWA, in a sense, as they might see Adolf Hitler, as someone who wants to destroy the Jewish character, the Jews in that state. Of course, that's complete nonsense. There's nothing anti-Semitic about UNRWA. And in fact, all the allegations that the Israelis have made about UNRWA staff being part of the October attacks, none of that has been substantiated. It's a mother of all lies. And the independent Kelowna investigation, so-called after the former French foreign minister, found that Israel produced absolutely no evidence to substantiate its claims that UNRWA staff had taken part. And yet, a large number of donors cut off their funds to UNRWA. They bought in to this mythology that UNRWA had taken part in this. It was complete nonsense, but it gave all of the justification that Israel needed to try and get rid of UNRWA. For them, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get rid of UNRWA, so they quickly spirited through the Israeli parliament 2 bills which have outlawed UNRWA, and that meant it became impossible for UNRWA to operate. For me, the real shame is that the UN Secretary General never really stood up and said, we should turn UNRWA's main headquarters in Jerusalem, 10 acres, a huge great property, into a surge hub for Gaza, and to move all the other agencies, World Food Programme, UNICEF, OCHA, all the others, into that. And that would have made it much more difficult for the Israelis to kick UNRWA out. That never happened. The UN, frankly, buckled and blinked, and the rest is history. UNRWA's headquarters in occupied East Jerusalem, which is the last big international presence in East Jerusalem, that is now gone. And actually, what's so terrifying but true, if you look at Gaza, it's a massive, isolated Palestinian community where all hope has been drained and they're being starved of the essentials of life. And that is because the Palestinians truly are the dispossessed of the earth. They have been denied the right of self-determination. They've been denied the right to their own state. And now they're being denied the right to life on an industrial scale. And I use the word industrial advisedly, because that is what, as we know from not too distant European history, was perpetrated against the Jews. And what we're now seeing today is people, a nation, however you want to call it, against whom the Holocaust was perpetrated, we are seeing those same people create a concentration camp in southern Gaza. How clangingly ironic is that? And my fear is that this isn't so much or just a concentration camp. I think it may well be a transit camp. People are going to be told, well, either you go, get off your land, you have no right of return, you have no collective individual rights, you don't have the right to self-determination, get lost. But if you want to stay behind, we'll simply starve you out. And that is the stark choice that the people of Gaza face today. It's hard to conceive of evil that's this bad, so it's hard to say, yes, I thought of it. On the other hand, once you have a people that can weaponize the Holocaust, that can weaponize anti-Semitism, that is a prescription for the worst kind of violence the world has ever known, frankly. And I think what we're now seeing in Gaza, it's pretty much up there with the worst violence the world has ever known. There is this great acronym PEP, which is Progressive Accept Palestine, and I think it really applies to a lot of governments. They can be very liberal about some things, so I don't think that necessarily applies to the Trump administration, but certainly the British government here and other European governments, they are liberal on pretty much everything except for Palestine, where there is absolute fear of the Israel lobby. There's a lot of guilt about the Holocaust, and there's a lot of pressure and I think aggression and bullying from the Israel lobby. And I think those different dynamics play very heavily on Israel-Palestine policy. And I think that explains this concept of the PEP. There's a perfect storm, if you like, of dynamics that come to bear on this. And it's very unfortunate for Palestinians. You've got, you know, these historical, these political, these economic, all of these factors that just, you know, weigh so heavily against the international community doing the right thing for you. It's very clear to me that at the level of the people, we have won. There's clear acknowledgement on a mass scale that the injustices perpetrated against the Palestinians, the denial of their right to self-determine and the mass industrial scale slaughter they're now experiencing is completely unjustifiable. But it's at the level of government that the Palestinians are isolated. And that's because the Israel lobby is so much in control. I mean, the attacks on me are pretty much history, but there were quite a few attacks on me. Of course, I was called, I'm a raging anti-Semite, of course. The UN ambassadors of Israel started a campaign writing to the Secretary General a very public letter asking for me to be sacked, for my salary, my pension to be taken away, all that sort of stuff. But I mean, that pales into insignificance compared with what the Palestinians have gone through. I think the reason why the lobby has got stronger and stronger is because at every stage, Western governments in particular have simply buckled. And the lobby has been sent a signal that the more you put pressure on us, the more you make unsubstantiated allegations, the more you accuse us erroneously of anti-Semitism, the more that works and the more we'll give way to you. And so incrementally, we've seen the lobby empowered. But make no mistake about it, it is the complicity of Western governments in that empowerment that has allowed that to happen and has allowed us to get to the stage today where a Western-backed, live-streamed genocide is taking place, and we still have a situation where no meaningful sanctions can be brought against Israel. And in spite of the brilliant report by Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur for the Situation of Human Rights, she has shone a light into the profiteering from the genocide.
My report exposes a system, something that is so structural. The economy of the occupation has turned into an economy of genocide. And so there have been people and organizations that have profited from the violence, the killing, the maiming, the destruction in Gaza and in other parts of the occupied Palestinian territory.
In spite of that, governments aren't just refusing to take action, they're pushing back against her. And in the case of the US, they've sanctioned her, which of course is a violation of the UN Privileges and Immunities Convention. And it's a moral abomination that someone as brave and as fearless as Francesca, an individual doing a job for which, by the way, she receives absolutely no pay whatsoever, can have the most powerful government in the world threatening her in this way. It's an absolute disgrace. And what a shame that countries, the UK and others, Italy, haven't made a more forceful defence of her. I mean, that's disgraceful. I think the UN has to think very, very carefully about the sanctions against Francesca. Volker Türk, the human rights czar of the United Nations, spoke out. The Human Rights Council has made a statement, and others have. But the fact is that if you can sanction Francesca, why can't you sanction the Secretary General? The problem will come back to bite the UN on the backside if it doesn't stand up very firmly for Francesca. And on the imprisonment thing, I mean, in the UK, the government is using anti-terrorism legislation against demonstrators. I mean, clearly the legislation should have been used against terrorists. The idea of using this anti-terror legislation to imprison people who are protesting against a genocide puts these governments on the wrong side of history, but it is a very slippery slope. If you can imprison people for demonstrating against genocide, then, you know, I hate to think where that goes, but it goes to a very, very bad place in terms of democracy. Well, the rule book's been thrown away, so the next time anyone invades a country, Britain, America, and others will be laughed at if they say, I'm sorry, it's a violation of international law. You know, Netanyahu, Gallant, and others are allowed to get away with invading, occupying. The occupation has gone on for since 1967. You know, that has been, the international rule book was there. It's never been applied. But I think what we've seen with Gaza, we've seen the attacks on Karim Khan, the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. We've seen all sorts of action against people who are trying to stand up for international law. There's even a story that's out recently that David Cameron, the then Foreign Secretary, phoned up the International Criminal Court and said, if you proceed with these cases against Yoav Gallant and Netanyahu, we will defund. A British Foreign Secretary phoning up an international justice mechanism charged with implementing international law and threatening to defund it. I mean, what better illustration can you possibly have of the attitude of so-called Western democracies towards international rule of law? And I think once that rule book has been thrown away, the world is in a very difficult place, because the whole idea of the Holocaust, for example, and the way it's been commemorated is never again. And all of the international law that grew up because of those appalling events of the 1930s and 40s, very much in response to the Holocaust and the treatment of the Jews, that's all being thrown away. And the hugely resounding irony is the reason that is being thrown away is the behaviour of the Jewish state. And for me, that is unconscionable. Double Down News brands itself as the future of journalism. And I have to say, the more I consume media stuff, the more I think they really are the future of journalism. They dare to say things which other people don't. They dare to challenge the narrative, the orthodoxy that's pervaded by many of mainstream media. And I think for that reason alone, amongst many others, I think they're really worthy of your support. So join the future of journalism. Support Double Down News on Patreon.